Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Do you guys think that via media, is that how you say it, Jana?
Yes.
Do you think that that kind of challenges the very structure of the church's benevolent patriarchy? Is that even something that we want to do or should do?
Those are very different questions. I think that, for one thing, we're all sitting around here having a conversation about how best to subvert patriarchy, which is troubling and, you know, delightful at the same time. But the fact that women in the church have to expend so much energy into agitating for change in ways that don't appear to be agitation
right.
is agitating.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is why this discussion is so important.
This we can try this for a while and then see what happens. I mean, you've got to, are you really ready to wage war, Jana? Or, how do you proceed to change the patriarchal system in the church? What would you do?
Well, I think it's different for every person. And I have a great relationship with the bishopric of my ward. I think that if I came to them with an idea, then they would certainly be receptive to it, and that they love me, that I have no doubt in my mind about that. This probably, for me, the way that I am most active in embracing change is through my writing, and sometimes that can be very empowering, and sometimes it's tremendously painful when I've written something and put myself out there, and the reception is sometimes quite threatened by this. And it was really kind of wonderful. A couple of weeks ago, I wrote a blog post about why I don't go to church on Mother's Day. Well, I don't go to sacrament meeting. I go to the rest of it. But sacrament meeting on Mother's Day is just such a minefield for me in multiple ways. And I, as part of that whole negotiation process, I gave myself permission to disengage from going to church on Mother's Day, and it's a delightful thing to just stay home and read a novel that first hour and then go to church afterwards. But when I went to church, one of the counselors in the bishopric approached me in the hallway, and he said, "Oh, you should have been here for sacrament meeting." And then he kind of lowered his voice and he said, "Well, okay, one of the talks was exactly like you said it would be, you know, where someone is lauding motherhood with every possible praise, and this woman who had 57 children." And
no.
But the other two talks were great. And then he said, "One of them was great because I printed out your talk and I gave it to the speaker," which was wonderful to hear.
I read the piece and I thought it was very well taken. Of course, my answer to the Mother's Day issue is, well, for one thing, it gives us something to talk about, and legitimately. I mean, we complain about the chauvinism and condescension of the man under that thing, and we can strike terror into their hearts, which we do whenever we can. But I think the simple answer is you just put women on the program. Let women speak.
Yes, talk
absolutely. About their mothers, talk about their experience. That's the only thing that's, you know, guarantees a good meeting. And anyway, that's the thing to do.
Yes. There was in the Mother's Day program in our ward, one of the men, there were two women asked to speak and one man, and the man who stood up, he said, you know, he's like, you know, what a complicated, you know, holiday. And he said, the fact that I've been asked to speak, that it makes me recognize that the bishopric sees me as expendable.
Oh, no.
So anyway, but, you know, I think that the thought came back to me is that, you know, I do. One of the things is, I think, with respect to the patriarchy, and I totally agree with you, Jana, that it's agitating that we have to agitate so quietly for change. There's no question about it. And yet I don't really know another way around it, in my experience. I do think that, you know, if you're seen as someone who is invested in the group and invested in the well-being of those around you, I think you're received better than if you are seen as someone who is angry and, you know, attacking. And so I think people receive it better. Now, I mean, that's not to say that people who have been more open and angry haven't also affected change, but it is more of a personal cost to them, I would imagine. And maybe I'm just not willing to pay that big of a cost. If maybe I would be if I really thought it would make things different. But I also find that I do pretty openly, I mean, as I'm now over 40, and so I'm speaking up pretty honestly. You know, I just will say, you know, I think patriarchy, you know, I teach the marriage and family relations class. I teach my own curriculum. I've kind of loosely followed what's in the given manual, but I really have created my own. And I just openly talk about the fact that patriarchy undermines emotional and physical intimacy in marriages, that I talk about the fact that this is a way that people have tried to create a system that deals with the fundamental human dilemmas of intimate relationships and people having to deal with conflict. And that I don't know, I just openly talk about the fact that I think it's garbage. And I say it in nice ways, and I give models of Christianity as a sort of a secondary or as another way of thinking about human relationships and what they're about and what we're striving towards within them. And they're well received. So I'm struck sometimes by what people will accept and take from me, especially when people are looking to solve problems that the kind of given doctrine hasn't necessarily been helpful to them with. So they're more open to other, they're open to other ways of understanding their struggles. And, you know, so I guess I'm saying that I have become more willing and able to say what I think, and I've been struck by how much I've still been received and tolerated.
I bet people thank you for that, don't they?
They absolutely do. They do. They absolutely
do. Yeah. It's a very valuable service you provide.
It really is. And in our email discussions back and forth, Jennifer, you said something that was impactful, and I've heard you say it before. You talked about when people voice their opinions and are authentic in their interactions, while it might and may make people uncomfortable initially, it tends to raise the spiritual maturity of the group. You could probably say that more eloquently than I can, but at what point do you feel like, I guess what I'm trying to get at is there a point when voicing an alternative opinion no longer raises the spiritual maturity of the group and just becomes uncomfortable, or does it always elevate the spiritual maturity of a group?
Well, what I would say is that it doesn't necessarily raise it, you know, because people can get rid of dissenters or they can be dismissive of it. But, you know, I really believe in the metaphor of the body of Christ, and that we're all a part of this moral conversation, that we're all contributors to it, and that when, you know, within a marriage or within a religious community, when somebody silences themselves and defers to someone else's reality, both people lose. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so when people will speak openly about what they feel and engage in the struggle that ensues, you know, we give short shrift to conflict, and much conflict, I think, is meaningful and important. That, you know, that I remember when I was younger and people would talk about things they didn't believe or would express dissent, my anxiety would go way up. I didn't want them to be saying what they were saying. But I think those were really important perspectives for me to think about and to start, you know, struggling with internally and pushing myself on what do I really think about this and what do I really believe on this front. So it doesn't necessarily promote spiritual growth, but I certainly think it's fundamental to it, meaning it gives us an invitation to be what I think Christ asks us to be, which is to reach outside of what is comfortable for us and to reach out to other children of God and to really understand their experience and to love them even though we may be uncomfortable, to understand them and to, you know, learn from them, even if it means we have to rearrange our worldview a bit. So,
Do you think that all people deserve to belong? Do you think that there's a point where middle way or via media that there's a point to where people don't get to belong anymore?
No.
Child molesters, maybe. I mean, I'm being a little
facetious.
It's really
up to them. It's really up to them if they, back off from activity or things. You can cease to belong easily enough, but it's your choice, I think.
So, okay.
I mean, I think it's being, striving to be Christ-like. It's to reach out to all of God's children. I mean, I think even if it makes us uncomfortable. So I do think the group owes loyalty to its members, even if the members disagree with the main line.
Okay, so I want to move into a little bit of a different discussion, and then we'll kind of summarize some of the main points that we talked about, and we'll wrap things up. And before I move into this last part of the discussion, are there any points that are on any of your minds that you really want to hit, or a direction that you really want to go that we haven't gone yet or focus on?
I've got just one quick thing. I think we've had a couple of wonderful ideas that have been raised here about tangible things that wards can do to make things better for women, for everyone. And in the spirit of that, one of the best Relief Society lessons that I ever taught was where I just threw the manual aside and said, our topic for the day is this. We rearranged the chairs in a circle, and I had all of the women go around and answer three questions. The topic was the celestial kingdom. And so the questions were, what is your idea of heaven? What experience have you had on earth that has most approximated your idea of heaven? And finally, what question do you have when you cross over? What will be your question? And it was a phenomenal thing, not least of which for me, because what I found was that several of the women I had perhaps pigeonholed in my mind as being Molly Mormon or very conservative had questions that blew me away, including one woman who, pillar of the ward, said, who is Mother in Heaven and why don't we hear more about her?
Wow.
That's about the last question I would have expected to hear from that particular person. And it was great. So my point is that insofar as we can, anytime we can, we need to encourage women to tell their stories and to throw out the manual, throw out whatever we need to do in order to get women talking.
I love that. I love that suggestion.
Yeah.
I do too. It really leads right into my oral history. So all of you ladies should write your stories and get them into my collection. I would love to have them.
Claudia, tell us more about your project. I heard a little bit about it last weekend, and I was so blown away by how much potential there was in that project. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, this is a project we started at Claremont Graduate University when we got a grant for $10,000 to do something for women. And we just didn't know what to do, but we decided we'd do an oral history because it would be valuable for everybody. It'd be valuable for the students who learned to do it, and they would have materials to work with. It'd be valuable for the people who are interviewed because they would value their own stories. They'd think about their lives. They would have a document when they were done. It'd be valuable for the future because we would have this great trove of women's stories signed and dated from the present time. And so we've been doing it for 3 years now, and it's some of the best time I spend doing anything. It's we just have these wonderful accounts from people, and as Jana says, people say things you do not expect, and they say wonderful things. So we have now, and I know this doesn't even sound like that many, but we have about 160 done now, but every one of these is a big job, and they range about 15 to 35 single space pages, and we're doing it for the future. Meanwhile, our students are getting lots of opportunities to present papers and write essays. And it's just been a very good thing for all of us. So you'll have my email address. Send me all the email addresses. I'll send you the instructions for writing your own story, which is really a good way to do it. I did my own story. Why should I speak it and then transcribe it? I just wrote it from scratch, and that worked very well. But anyway, it's a good thing. What we've got is our own lives, our own stories, and they are what we will have that help us to live in the annals of the world for the rest of our rest of eternity, We may be living in cloud space and so on, but we need our stories written here. They're going to last. So it's something you should do. That's the
love it.
Wonderful.
I love it. I think that's fantastic. And I love that suggestion, Jenna. I think that's remarkable. And, you know, my mom shared a story with me last week, and she's been listening to Mormon Matters and Mormon Stories, and she's kind of in her own transition and seeing things a little bit differently. And she talked about teaching the Relief Society lesson and asking all the women to give answers that were from their heart and from their experience, that weren't wasn't full of the vocabulary that they'd learned their whole life, that weren't cookie cutter answers that they've given, you know, in other lessons, but to just speak from their heart. And she talked about this tremendous outpouring of connection and experience that was expressed. And it just really elevated everybody to be able to speak authentically and to connect in a different way. And so I think sharing stories and encouraging women to be authentic in their discussions are fantastic ways for all of us to be, quote, real Mormons, middleway Mormons, all these fantastic terms that we're coming up with. So those are great.
And I think, you know, I think if there were more authenticity in Relief Society meetings, you'd never have to kind of, you know, guilt people into going anymore. I mean, it's, you know, whenever the ideals are spoken and people feel like that's what I'm supposed to be, but that's not what I am, it becomes, you know, the opposite of a spiritual experience. It's invalidating. Mm-hmm. It makes you feel bad. Mother's Day talks make you feel bad. So instead, you know, if you can come there and actually feel like I identify with the women, I identify with their questions, with their struggles, you want to be there. And that's when the spirit bears witness, you know, yes. It's when people are being true and they're saying what their real experience is.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Okay, so here's the next question that I have for you guys. When do we become, as women, responsible for the negative effects of our community or of our institution? And how much does that play into our Mormonism and our activity in the community? Are we responsible for the negative effects of an institution when we're part of it?
I guess I don't feel very responsible because I don't have much to do with it. I don't have any power over it. I mean, I only have the power to influence what I can. And so I can certainly speak up against the things I disagree with, but I can't make the institution do different things. And so I speak openly about what I agree with and disagree with, or what I think is wrong and right, but that's about where I feel my responsibility lies.
Okay. Jana, Claudia?
Yeah, there's been a lot of discussion about that just this year with Mitt Romney running for president, and some journalists, for example, looking at him and saying, well, he is responsible for the fact that the LDS Church was so very racist and possibly remains racist. He is responsible for the church's oppression of women, etc. I'm glad that there are journalists who are putting pressure on the church to change and to take a hard look at itself. But do I think that Mitt Romney is personally responsible for those things? No, I don't. You know, I'm in this church as well, and there's a limit to what we can change. I paid taxes to a government that was involved in two wars in the last decade that I didn't agree with. I didn't stop paying my taxes. You know, we are all complicit. It's not a perfect world, as much as we would like it to be one.
Yeah, and it's not a perfect institution as much as we would like it to be one.
Certainly not.
Yes, but you know, I have a lot of sympathy for the general authorities too. It's not easy to run a big institution like this. And having been married to the bishop and the stake president, it's not easy to run any of that stuff, you know, especially people doing it on top of other things and without any special training. It's hard business. So
we've
got to be sympathetic to our poor leaders as well as ourselves.
So maybe while we don't necessarily have control or even impact per se over any negative effects of an institution, maybe we do have a responsibility in that we need to be authentic. We need to voice our opinions. We need to point out injustices and do what we can on a personal level with those that we interact with to make things right when there's an opportunity. So maybe that's where our responsibility starts and ends, is what we have power to do in our inner circles and to those whom we teach and have stewardship over in our callings, et cetera, et cetera. Now, how about raising children? I want to spend the last little bit of our time talking about raising children in the church, because as women, this, and as a woman, this is always on the top of my mind. How best to be a mother? How best to teach my children? How best to raise them so that they don't have to go through some of the hard things I've gone through? And I imagine that that's the case across the board for all moms. And so in regard to raising children, you know, as we look to be authentic in our Mormonism, as we strive to be, quote, real Mormons, you know, are we setting our children up for future dissonance when we try to walk the middle way with them? You know, what happens when they discover that their family's perspectives on truth and religion are a little bit different than maybe their neighbors who get the same Sunday school lessons, or maybe their family's perspectives are different than what they're hearing at church? Now, are we setting them up for dissonance? What would you women say about that?
Well, my perspective is, you know, I think that, you know, there's no group in which anybody's going to belong perfectly ever, you know, including any marriage or family, or any other religion for that matter. It's a function of the imperfection of life, is that, you know, that we all want to belong to each other, but we also want to belong to ourselves. And that is to say that we want to matter to those around us and have a place, but we want to be true to who we are also. And so that inevitably creates tensions that, you know, that people have to work out and learn how to be true to themselves at the same time that they're true to others. So I think that how I see it in my own life is that I don't think there's going to be a moment of disillusionment for my children, because I think that it's sort of just an open conversation, grappling with what I believe and what I think other, you know, what their primary teachers may believe or teach them, and that they may be different things. And that, you know, I guess I'm suggesting to my kids that it's a moral conversation, and no one person is going to, or group is going to give you all the right answers, that's part of our spiritual journey, is to grapple with those questions. And so seeing things.
But Jennifer, yeah, can I interrupt you for just a minute? Do you worry though that you tell your children that, but then the lessons that they're getting at church are very clear that this is God's word, this is the way it is?
Yeah, well, and I just say to my kids, you know, I give them a different interpretation of that, which is that, you know, that I don't think it's so simple, that I see it differently, that our making truth claims is a way to kind of assert that we're doing what this is our best attempt at what we believe is true, but that it's always evolving both in the church and within individuals, and that there's never one place to stand that it's always going to be right. And so I guess I just feel like that I'm living it, and I think they're seeing that I'm living it, and that they're watching me navigate those tensions. So I may be naive, and of course this is an ongoing experiment, as all parenting is, but you know, I think that it's okay. And I think it's showing them my ability to kind of hold on to who I am in the face of people disagreeing with me, I think is not a disservice to them at all. I think it prepares them to, you know, I try to prepare them with that even in their, you know, challenges at school, that their friend disagrees that the song they like is a cool song. Well, you know, can you hold on to the fact that you like it even if your friend doesn't? You know, do you need to conform to what he thinks just, you know, so that you can feel okay? You have to basically change your opinion about the song. Can you just hold on to the fact that you like it and let him see it differently? I think that's a life skill that's extremely important. And so I guess I feel like it's part of life, and I don't see that giving a child I think you actually do a greater disservice to children to give them a very simple notion of how the world works, because then the disillusionment is extraordinarily disorienting.
Can you just write a book already, Jennifer? My goodness. Just write it already. That's great. I that's actually a really good perspective, and I love that. And it makes me want to go get a PhD in psychology so I can be as brilliant as you are. Jana and Claudia, what about you? What do you think about raising kids in the middle way? Or as, quote, real Mormons.
Well,
what's your take on that?
You know, for us, it's very different. My husband, as you probably know, is Episcopalian. And so we gave our daughter the choice of, we have just one child, what she would like to do when she turned 8. And when she turned 8, she was not ready to make a decision. But when she was about 10 and a half, she decided she wanted to be baptized in the Episcopal Church. And so she is now a member of that church and an acolyte many Sundays and is very happy there.
How old is she, Janet? How old is your daughter?
She's now 13 and taller than I am, which is really freaking me out. I think that for us, the challenges are different. The challenge of our family is, how do we raise a child to respect the integrity of two different religious traditions and to understand the differences between them while also always emphasizing the many, many things that we share. I haven't gotten a lot of great instruction for that in the LDS Church, but I have looked to, it's actually surprising to me how many families write to me and are in a similar situation where, and maybe some of the listeners to this podcast will resonate with this, of trying to raise kids in two different religious traditions and the particular challenges that that brings. But I think Phil and I both prefer to emphasize the opportunities that it offers kids to, you know, my daughter is loved and welcomed in two different religious communities, and she still comes to activities and some things at the LDS Church, and she does the activities and all of the Sunday things at her church. But for her, it's a great thing to be just to be loved in two different places by two different kinds of people.
As to mothering, I think it's very easy for us as mothers to think we have more influence than we actually do. Mm-hmm. After a while, you cannot make another person do anything that they do not care to do, or believe anything that they do not care to believe. I mean, you're just one of many cultural influences that is teaching your children all the time, and I'm not sure that we're even the major one sometimes. Mm-hmm. So children do what they do to a large extent. I think we do our best. Everybody does their best, but you know, there are no guarantees for this kind of a situation, no matter what you do. So that's my statement at this point.
Do you think that raising daughters in the church requires kind of a different approach or strategy than raising boys?
I think I would say that I think, you know, patriarchy is bad for boys and girls, but I would say it's probably even more costly for girls. So, you know, I have a little 6-year-old and I have two boys that are 12 and 10 and then a 6-year-old girl. And so I've been grappling with the question more as she's starting to become sort of more aware of things. But you know, I guess I'm pretty open with my children about what I think about, you know, that I believe that the structure in the church is one that's based in our cultural history, not in any divine truth, and that I see it as man-made, and that I emphasize that we believe in parents in heaven, a mother and a father that care for my kids just as their earthly mother and father do, And so I'm just, you know, giving them lots of messages like that. Now, that's not to say that they aren't seeing the sea of suits also and aren't seeing that men get preferential treatment, if that's the right way to say it, that you know, women hold a secondary status. But in my own life, I'm hopeful that what they see at home is a sufficient buffer also because, you know, they really do see parents who function as equal players. And so... so it's really about being in an open conversation with them. And I also agree fully with Claudia that, you know, there's only so much influence one can have. It's not like that our kids don't watch a lot of television. I think there's all kinds of horrible messages just on turning on the TV about women and sexuality mm-hmm. and everything else. But, you know, when my kids take in media, I also try to stay in a conversation with them about it to help them be better consumers of the perspectives that are around them. So I kind of see that as part of my role as a parent to help them be conscious consumers of ideas.
Fantastic. Claudia, Jana, what do you think about the difference between raising girls and boys? Do you think there needs to be a different approach?
You know, I'm working on the early stages of a book called Growing Up Mormon, which is look at Mormon childhood and adolescence from 1950 to the present as a lens for understanding Mormon culture. And
interesting.
Yeah, it's been fascinating. You know, as I said, this is still in the preliminary stages and I'm late with my book proposal and all of that. So not a lot new there, but it's been utterly fascinating to sit down with people and interview them and hear their stories. And this question of socialization of girls in the LDS church has come home to me a little bit more thoroughly in the course of doing just these preliminary interviews. And I'm frankly glad that this is something that I don't really have to worry about when my daughter goes to the Episcopal Church. There is such a completely different understanding of male and female leadership as complete parity. There's no rhetoric of separate but equal, which is, it never works in any scenario.
Yeah.
And so, frankly, I spend a good amount of time being grateful that she's kind of protected from some of these
Jana,
very
that's
damaging...
not helping me.
I'm sorry. I'm just being honest. You know, these very damaging messages. A couple of weeks ago, I spoke at a retreat and someone did a wonderful PowerPoint presentation about, it was called Cinderella Ate the Laurels. And it was basically about the princessification of Mormon girl culture, which was fascinating and disturbing. But, you know, frankly, they don't have that in the Episcopal Church, really at all. And it's nice.
Yeah.
So I'm hearing a resounding yes.
Yeah.
Yes, maybe there needs to be a little bit of a different strategy with our daughters than our boys, even though patriarchy is not a good system, you know, mm-hmm. from any angle.
Well,
maybe
I remember
yes.
hearing Jennifer speak, just this fantastic thing that she did at a retreat a number of years ago. And one of the things she pointed out was that in the lesson manuals for young men and young women, there's a lesson called Choosing Your Eternal Companion in the Young Men's Manual. And the corresponding lesson to that in the Young Women's Manual is Becoming an Eternal Companion. You know, the idea that we would remove agency from girls, that we would essentially have them live in this narrative where they are waiting to be plucked, is deeply disturbing.
Yes.
Let me give a little shout out for beginningsnew.org, I think is what it is. It might be beginningsnew.blogspot.com. If you Google Beginnings New, it's a fantastic website that goes through all the young women's manuals, and it gives some good ideas on how to reframe some of the terminology and the wording in the lessons. And I think it's important to point out, too, that the curriculum and the way that we present the doctrine of the church is so radically different than the gospel of Jesus Christ mm. that we all participate in and are members of. And a lot of our problems kind of start and end right there in our manuals. And luckily, those are things that can change. You know, they're not part of our doctrine, their interpretations of our doctrine. And so sites like Beginning New and Wave also has some great, wave.org also has some great resources to help kind of change some of the lessons and kind of refocus some of the lessons onto more gospel principles as opposed to some of these goofy, choosing an eternal companion versus preparing to be an eternal companion. Claudia, what are your thoughts about raising daughters versus raising boys, sons in the church?
Well, I have the most children, and of course, we're past that now. All my children are older and married and so on, but I didn't feel that much difference about the way I raised them. We went to certainly different meetings. I would say that for my childhood, I grew up in a family of girls, and just there were four of us, and that the church was just a wonderful, perfect, marvelous place for girls at that time. We did lots of wonderful things. That's when we had all the cultural programs of music and dancing and speech and everything else, drama. And it was very rich and a wonderful thing. Not theologically, but theologically was not the important thing. What we had was this marvelous culture. We had a dance every week. We had wonderful times. And I felt that church much long lacking for my children when they grew up, because I thought it was very valuable. Instead, we moved into seminary and stuff like that. But so I wouldn't say that I would have raised the children. No, I think the children we just pretty much raised the same way. I didn't worry about those differences. But my daughters are the ones that are not active in the church. My boys are. So there's the lesson.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. If you could go back, Claudia, and raise your children again, or better said, if you had children today, young children today in the church, would you do things differently?
One of the things I would do is agitate for a Saturday night sacrament meeting for couples, because it seems to me that the church is terribly divisive of families, that we really ought to manage some other kind of way of going to church. I feel like the women are the martyrs of our church. All those poor women managing to get dressed every morning, Sunday morning, and dress up those little kids and bring them and keep them for 3 hours. No, that's asking an awful lot. So I would change the structure. As for my children, I don't know that I would do different things. I would encourage more of the kinds of activities that I really liked. But I like the activities better than the theology anyway.
So. I can't wait to interview you for my book, because this is kind of what I'm hoping to chronicle, is a lot of this lost world.
Yes, well, I certainly remember it very clearly and valued it highly and have benefited from it my whole life.
That's great. I mentioned that I was with Carolyn Klein a week or two ago, and we were talking about this very thing, raising daughters in the church versus raising boys in the church. And one of the things that she shared with me that I've been thinking a lot about, and I've actually shared it with a handful of other women with whom I've had this similar conversation, you know, what about our daughters? What about our kids? How do we save them from the dissonance or the tension that we've experienced moving from, you know, one stage of faith to the next, you know, recognizing patriarchy and not liking so many parts and things about it? How do we save our daughters? And one of the things that Caroline said that I thought was so profound, yet so simple, she said for herself, she came to a point where she decided to respect and honor the stages of faith that her children were destined to go through in their own lives. Mm-hmm. And I've been giving that a lot of thought, and I think there's a lot of value to that. And, you know, Claudia, when we started talking, one of the things that you said that I thought was really interesting and that you're right on about is that there's no perfect institution. There's no perfect organization. Jennifer, you said the same thing. There's no perfect group for everybody. There's always going to be things you like and don't like, things that work and don't work. And regardless of what group or institution or organization or religion I raise my children in, they will still experience their own stages of faith. That's a natural spiritual progression that all human beings go through. And allowing my children and honoring the fact that they will have those experiences for themselves, irrespective of their tradition, really gave me a lot of peace. And so I throw that out in the hopes that Caroline's words that gave me so much peace might also put some of our listeners at ease too, as they grapple with some of the more difficult aspects of, you know, growing in your tradition and agitating for opportunities. And so with that, my goodness, we've covered a lot of ground, and I hope we've covered enough. But before we wrap all the way up, is there anything else that anybody would like to talk about? Is there anything on anybody's mind that we haven't dug into?
You know, I don't know if you want to go here or not, but I think something that maybe it's not really within the scope of this podcast, but I think thinking about how, you know, people that are going through that, are trying to find their place within the larger LDS community, but also it can create real challenges within one's marriage and within one's family. And I don't know if you want to focus on that.
You know what, let's do. Let's take a few minutes and talk about that, see where it goes, because I think that's very, very valuable.
Yeah. I don't know if I have anything to say on it yet, but hang on.
Well, and maybe I can just, you know, say that sometimes when there's a shift in views, when there's a transition that happens from that black and white to that kind of multicolored variation, there's some tension that can happen in a relationship. And it's a similar that we were talking about in our communities at church. When somebody voices an opinion that looks a little bit different than the rest of the group, there maybe is a little bit of discomfort. And certainly that's the case in a marriage. And so middle way Mormonism, looking at things through a little bit of a different lens, more authentically, certainly can create some tension in a relationship. And part of middle way, I think, is figuring out how to navigate your relationships when there's a difference of opinion and perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, at least in my experience clinically, is when I've worked with women who were going through their own shifts in their perspectives on their faith, that there could be more of a crisis around identity too, because it's like, who am I, you know, as the wife, as the mother, to be having these kinds of questions and issues? Who am I to be making my husband feel uncomfortable, or to be challenging the question of whether or not we pay a full tithe, or to be, you know, that sort of this question around, like, I'm so far off, you know, to be doing this, and yet that struggling between, I'm not the right kind of woman, I'm not the right kind of wife, and yet I feel all of these things. And it can really cause a lot of tumult internally as well as within a marriage.
How do you encourage women and or men to deal with that?
Well, you know, I guess what I would say is it's part of all marriages. I mean, this, the fact that people change, and that, you know, that people don't always change in the directions and the ways that you want them to. And basically, you know, how much it's an opportunity for people to grow in sometimes painful and acutely painful ways, you know, that people get confronted with the question of, you know, you're stressing me out, all of your doubts and your questions, and yet I still love you. And so is there some way that we can care for one another and still sort of tolerate the process that you know, one of us is going through? So it can often be a breaking point for couples, but it can also, in my experience, be something that really pulls couples together ultimately, where they learn how to really love and know one another, even if what one person is, where one person is landing is making the other person uncomfortable. But I've seen a lot of people become stronger within that struggle over time.
And I couldn't help but think about that same experience happening in our local communities and wards when something happens. I love this person. They're viewing things in a different way that make me a little bit uncomfortable, and I might not agree with, but I can't deny the fact that I love this person, and I'm invested in them, and they're invested in mm-hmm. me, and I want them to stay in this ward, in this church. I want their companionship. I want them to continue to challenge me because I love them.
Right.
So I think that's an interesting parallel.
Yes.
Yeah,
for sure. Jana or Claudia, either of you have any thoughts on that?
I can't think of a single thought. I'm having stupor of thought.
Well, I'm afraid I am too. I think I warned you that I'm basically useless after 10 p.m. and I'm afraid I'm to that point. I'm so sorry.
That's okay. The very last thing on my list is this very last part where we'll wrap up and then everybody can go to bed. And so in closing, I just want to thank you all so much for your insight and your input and your experience. I found this conversation to be extremely valuable and beneficial for me personally, and I'm sure that will be the case for all of our listeners. And so in closing, I would love each of us to just take a minute, each of you, to just take 20, 30 seconds and just share with us and our listeners what value you found in your Mormon tradition, and maybe some of the things that have benefited you from your participation in, you know, our Mormon community. And then we can kind of wrap things up. And Claudia, I'd love it if we could start with you.
Well, I would like to say that I'm very grateful for the church. My husband always says, when someone asks him how he can believe such things, he says, church is an institution that makes him more of the kind of a man that he wants to be. Mm-hmm. And I'm so grateful for having the teachings of the church, which I think move toward a life of reasonable moderation, peace, and happiness. I'm very grateful for the people that I know who are in this tradition, because they are such good people, and they make their people I would be happy to know for eternity. And so I value the teachings of the church. I also value the church as a sort of an arena on which we play. We model living managing a world, remodel, doing things together in ways that can bring us closer. We just model all sorts of good things. We are learning skills that we could use in managing the world, things like that. I value the church and its organization and its opportunities. Thank you very much, Chelsea.
Thank you, Claudia. That's beautiful. Jana?
Well, I feel similarly to Claudia. I think that the church provides people with tremendous opportunities for spiritual formation, and that is something I feel very passionate about. Sometimes I am critical of the way things are done, and I think that there are far better ways that we could do things, and you know, some of those we haven't even talked about. The things that I get, that I get my knickers in a twist about, like the absence of authentic worship and the real dearth of spiritual experience in any kind of corporate environment. You know, we're definitely encouraged to do that individually, but not so much together. And I mourn that loss. So it's not that I'm issue free, but I'm so glad to be a Mormon, and it has enriched my life beyond measure. So I'm grateful for it. And I'm grateful also for the chance to speak my mind. Thank you.
I'm glad you speak your mind too. Thank you. Jennifer, go ahead.
Well, very similar to Claudia and Jana, I feel tremendously grateful to be a Mormon. I feel like growing up in the church, and you know, when I read, I can't say it, a Book of Mormon Girl.
Joanna Brooks.
Joanna Brooks, sorry, couldn't say her name. It's getting late. I just so related to her early childhood experience or her youth experience. It was just so, I felt like I was reading my own journal in many ways. And, you know, I feel so much gratitude for what being a Mormon has meant for me in terms of placing me into a moral conversation, both internally and externally, and sort of pushing me to grapple with these questions of what is right and what is not right, and who am I and what do I want to be, and doing it within a community of people that have really cared deeply for me and that I care deeply for. And I feel lucky, you know, when I work with people, I work with non-LDS couples and clients as well as LDS couples and clients. And, you know, one of the big differences I see is not necessarily in what people do. You know, there's all kinds of troubles within couples in the church and out of the church. But what I see as a difference is there's more of a sense of belonging or of resources among members of the church, that there's a sense of having a place. And where I see non-LDS people as I experience them as more isolated within their communities. So I feel very grateful for that. This is my last thought of that. You know, I have a child with autism, and I feel tremendously grateful for the way that my ward has embraced him and embraced us. And, you know, just the way that people so lovingly give of the best in them to us. And it's meant so much to me. So I think there certainly are those tensions and limitations that sometimes really get me upset, but I'm also grateful to be getting upset within this group. So I'm thankful for it.
Fantastic. Well, thank you again, all three of you, for being on this panel. I can't express how much I value your opinions and your experiences, and I really appreciate the time that you've spent to be here this evening. And I just want to give another thanks to Dan for inviting me to participate and to host this panel. It's been a wonderful experience. And Dan, I hope you'll have me back. And again, to all of our listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, if there's anything that's been valuable or meaningful for you or given you pause to think, I hope you'll reach out and participate on the boards. Send an email to Dan, and if you feel so inclined, make a small donation. Everything helps and keeps this resource going, and we're really grateful for all of our listeners here at Mormon Matters, and thanks again so much, everybody, for participating. So good night to everybody, and hopefully we can have a great discussion again sometime in the future.
Thanks, Chelsea.
Thank you, Chelsea.
Thanks, everybody. Good night.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well.